The presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast is Takeda. And for that, we say
thanks Takeda.
Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 36, May 20th, 2019. I'm Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, we discuss transitioning into adulthood as someone with a bleeding disorder during our comment segment, connections between child anxiety and school absence during our like segment, and Jerron Hill shares his personal experience with hemophilia during today's share segment. Plus, positive psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy expert Dr. Galen Cole joins us for the interview segment. Debbie De La Riva is back with a moment for mental health, and Mama Sue returns for her latest streaming recommendations. All that and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. Natalie, hi. Welcome to Bloodstream.
Thanks.
Good to see you here again.
Oh, I love being here.
Nice to have you back. We've had a few like regularly scheduled episodes now.
Yeah, we're back. We're back in rhythm
here. We got a good rhythm. We've had a lot of episodes recently through Bloodstream and Bloodstream Media, but you and I have gotten to do our traditional eps for a while. Amongst those episodes that we've been releasing, the Empowering Women series. All three episodes are now out. Thank you to everybody who has listened, shared, and sent in feedback about the Empowering Women series. If you missed them or want to check them out again, you can find the episode list in your podcast app or go to bloodstreampod.com and click on the Empowering Women tab to listen to all three episodes of the Empowering Women series. I also want to let you know that we have launched the Teen Impact Awards for 2019. That's right, the fifth annual Teen Impact Awards are now open for nominations. As I'm sure listeners to this podcast are familiar, the Teen Impact Awards honor teens affected by bleeding disorders who are making a positive impact in their home, school, or community. This is the fifth annual awards. It'll take place the opening night of NHF Bleeding Disorders Conference, Thursday, October 3rd at 8:30 p.m. in Anaheim, California. Teens can be nominated for their impactful actions having taken place since last fall, September, October 2018, a.k.a. Since the fourth annual Teen Impact Awards. And teens do not need to be present to receive their Teen Impact Award. If a teen or family is not intending to go to the Bleeding Disorders Conference, that's okay. We can make sure that the award gets to them. They will be recognized during a video tribute, and then we can either send that award to their home chapter or to the parents of the honoree as determined by those parents. So, and finally, nominations can be made by anyone. So if you're listening and you know somebody in your local area or somebody that you met at a camp or a national meeting or in some kind of retreat or during a workshop who's making a positive impact in his or her home, school, or community, head on over to the teenimpactawards.com, teenimpactawards.com, or you can email teenimpactawards@believeltd.com with questions. Ryan Geelan, my co-founder at Bloodstream Media, he's going to be coming up a little bit later on this episode to talk to you a little bit more about the Teen Impact Awards. Natalie, are you going to nominate somebody for a Teen Impact Award this year?
There's a lot of teens I'm considering.
You know, you can nominate as many as you would like.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah, so you can.
I'm not limited to just one.
No, you can nominate 12 if you want. The selection committee may, you know, not ultimately go with all 12 that you nominate. That's up to the selection committee, but you can nominate up to 12.
Good. Up to 12.
I just decided. Yeah, just decided.
Good to know.
In other Bloodstream news, the latest episode of the Ask the Expert podcast features a conversation between host Amy Board and former NHF board chair Jorge De La Riva on the value of board service. So maybe you've considered serving on the board of your local chapter. Maybe you're just curious to know what exactly a board does. Well, go to bloodstreamexpert.com or find the Ask the Expert podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And as you know, I'm always asking to please leave Bloodstream and the Ask the Expert podcast a rating on iTunes. Many of you are responding to this call, so thank you. I appreciate it. But if you haven't,
do it.
Head on over to iTunes and leave a rating for Bloodstream and the Ask the Expert podcast. Share Bloodstream episodes on Facebook and on Twitter. Tell a friend. You know, this is the ninth podcast episode. Natalie, do you know this is the ninth episode that we've released in the past 8 weeks?
Wow, we're cranking them out.
Over 7.5 hours of content coming into this episode. So probably about 9 hours now with it, which is only made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. Thanks, Takeda. And of course, Ask the Expert is made possible by its sponsor, Bayer. Thank you, Bayer. And we have all of our segment sponsors. Thank you, segment sponsors.
Thank you.
But really, the only way this is all possible, if you get right down to it,
okay.
is because you're listening, you find it entertaining, you find it helpful. So if you do like what you're hearing, help support the podcast, spread the word, leave a rating, and let's keep it going. Again, you can email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll find us on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia, on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo, and you can also find me on Twitter @PJLynch.
And I'm on Twitter, but it's secret.
It's a ish. Bloodstream Podcast, episode 36, like segment, child anxiety may factor into school absences. But I have to tell you first that the segment is brought to you by the Teen Impact Awards. I don't know if you heard about this like 30 seconds ago, but the 5th Annual Teen Impact Awards, it's held annually on opening night of the National Hemophilia Foundation's Bleeding Disorders Conference, and it honors leaders of the future by recognizing teens affected by bleeding disorders who are making a positive impact in their home, school, or community. Head on over to teenimpactawards.com. That's teenimpactawards.com, or you can find the Teen Impact Awards on Facebook and on Instagram. Okay, child anxiety may factor into school absences. Natalie, tell us a little bit about what this article says and what it might mean.
So the article goes into multiple school absences. When a child has multiple school absences, that anxiety should be something that should be looked at, that it's not always so obvious, but when a kid misses school for unexcused non-medical reasons continually, that anxiety tends to, it seems to be that there's a trend. The article looked at a bunch of studies, like 4,000, over 4,000.
Yeah, 4,930.
Yeah, and then
conducted across North America, Europe, and Asia.
And then whittled it down to 11, which was just an interesting thing to note because it didn't really go into why these other studies were.
Siri, what percent of 100 is 11 out of 4,930?
It's about 0.002231%.
That's a very small percent.
Yeah, so, you know, it is interesting that both a study and an article is published when it's whittled down to so much. And even though it spans a bunch of continents, when it's whittled down to that 11, what is included in that longitudinal study?
Right, like just how broad a study is this?
So basically, I think what the article concludes is that there is a trend that's noticed, and that more studies need to occur to catch this link and to, you know, it is something to consider. And that with children, anxiety, it's not always like a child being able to.
Mom, I'm having anxiety today.
Yeah, I'm having anxious feelings. It's repeated tummy aches with no, you know, physiological reason for those tummy aches or headaches. So that's something
to
consider.
You know, we haven't looked into this, but I wonder if in general kids are more likely to point out physical symptoms of anxiety than they are to speak to anything that's mental or emotional about it. Because a tummy ache or headache, you know, that's physical. That's easy to put your finger on. As a kid, it might be much more difficult to come to a realization that like, hey, I'm having overinflated feelings about that relatively minor thing that occurred earlier. You know, like there's not a way to express that maybe better than like my tummy hurts.
Right.
You know? And so like we have to play as parents, adults, filters, like filter a little bit for that kind of stuff and be aware of what it could mean. You know, the point that you just said too, though, about the need for more research, that was one of the conclusions of the study, that there are gaps that should be a priority for future research, and how that there is a lack of longitudinal research, and yet almost 5,000 studies. They whittle it down to 11 and they're like, we need more.
Well, I just find it interesting that they didn't say why.
yeah, they didn't say like how did it become 11?
Yeah. Like what disqualified? Well, we're not going to use this one. Nah, this one's not very good either. That one, not good.
Somebody had a lousy job.
What was the criteria for that? So it's interesting. And I think it's important when you're reading any study to look at the numbers. And, you know, there's always, if it's not listed as in the article, embedded in the article, you can Google and find the abstract and the full research paper for these studies. So sometimes the articles that are in Psych Central or Psychology Today, it does behoove you to kind of look a little deeper before you take it as the word.
You know, we were talking about this a little bit yesterday in prepping for the podcast, how sometimes we hear about things that are quote unquote new, or there's new studies that are bringing to light a piece of information, and maybe the information is new, or maybe we're just now aware enough to look for it or to study it. You know, there might not be a rise in child anxiety, but it is interesting. If you Google child anxiety and just hit the news thing, there's tons. I mean, it seems like every day there's articles being written about child anxiety. Is it that much more common than it was 3 or 4 decades ago? I don't know. Maybe. We certainly know to look for it more than we did then. And we are aware of some trends to pay attention to and some correlations between, you know, what might be mistaken as a tummy ache when it's actually a physical symptom of anxiety. So that's something I'm curious about, is like, how much of this is new? And how much of this is just us knowing what to look for, how to look for it, and starting to answer some questions that were previously unanswered? Not to get too granular, but this study gets into unexcused absences and a particular correlation between unexcused absences and anxiety, as opposed to excused absences or absences as a result of mental distress. Like, it gets into some subcategories, but apparently there's a gray area of unexcused absences that anxiety seems to have a particular common appearance in. So
sure. And I agree with you. I don't know if there's an increase or if there's just a greater awareness, which is great. And May being Mental Health Awareness Month, it's just good that our national consciousness is looking at mental health in general and mental health of children. Like, let's nip this in the bud so that we can give children coping mechanisms so that they become adults with a strong tool bag to be able to navigate their mental health issues.
In the same way that they navigate their physical health, their bleeding disorders, health, whatever else, just get, you know, equip them with the coping mechanisms and the education necessary to take care of themselves. And I'm glad you mentioned that May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we obviously do a lot of mental health related content here on the Bloodstream podcast. But one thing, you know, obviously it's a cheap callback as the sponsor for this segment is the Teen Impact Awards. But one thing that I do truly believe in is you can't always remove challenges or remove the negative, but you can add a little more positive. You can add some incentive. But if you do know of a teen in this community, a high school or middle school age teenager affected by a bleeding disorder who's doing something great, maybe they're facing anxiety that's a little bit troublesome, but if we can at least recognize and honor them for something great they're doing too, I like to think that that helps.
For sure.
So if you know of somebody who could benefit, go over to the teenimpactawards.com. So anyway, I've made my piece, teenimpactawards.com, to celebrate and honor those who deserve it. And if you're interested, we'll have links to this article in the program notes, as well as in the article, you'll find links to the study itself if you want to get real nerdy with a couple of hours over your weekend. Thanks, Natalie.
You're welcome. Before we begin this month's A Moment for Mental Health segment, I'd like to tell you that this month it is brought to you by Stop the Bleeding, winner of the 2018 LA Webfests Award for Best Comedic Premise and nominated for a Norman Lear Imogen Award. Stop the Bleeding is a comedic and educational web series that uses humor to teach and stories to inspire people affected by bleeding disorders. From the importance of advocacy and prophylaxis to the effect of a bleeding disorder on siblings and family members, if it's a topic of importance to the bleeder community, chances are Stop the Bleeding has it covered. Visit stbhemo.com where you can watch all eight episodes.
Oh.
There's more than eight.
Okay. How many are there?
There's 8 seasons of the award-winning comedy series for free. That's stbhemo.com, or check out stbhemo on Instagram for bite-sized videos, memes, and other show-related content.
Welcome to our segment on mental health. My name is Amy Board, and in celebration of Mental Health Awareness Month, which is the month of May, we have a very special guest with us here for this segment. Ray Stanhope is a member of the community, and we are so excited to have him here to share some of his experiences with depression and his mental health struggles. Ray, welcome.
No, thank you very much.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you are connected to the community.
Background, I grew up as a military brat, connected to the community. I have severe factor 9 deficiency or hemophilia B.
And you spoke a little bit about your experience with depression and mental health struggles at a conference last week. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you shared with that community?
Sure. It was a local wellness program put on by the Gulf States HDC. I was asked to speak about my encounters with depression and the various things that I have used over the years to deal with depression. It went pretty well. First time speaking about depression, so I wasn't quite sure that I had everything I wanted to say lined out, but went pretty well.
And what was your experience with depression like? How did it manifest? And what were some of the words that you have put to it over the years as you've struggled with it?
Mostly I described it as being in quicksand, where you just feel kind of overwhelmed and incapable of moving in each direction without being sucked in further. As far as dealing with it, you know, certainly I've had several occasions where I've actually used medication to deal with it. I also have found doing a group setting of a support group. Also I found that a certain amount of physical activity also helps me with dealing with depression.
Have you experienced depression many times in your life?
Yes. I can do a look back and probably spot some times in my childhood that I had some depression. Could not put a name to it then, certainly when I was first diagnosed with HIV, that triggered my first bout with depression that I was actually able to put a name to what was going on.
For our listeners that are maybe trying to put words to what's happening within them, what advice can you offer them if they are struggling, if they are feeling hopeless, if they are feeling like they are in quicksand? What are some advice that you can give them?
Well, certainly being aware of that you're not feeling normal about what's going on. And then having a support group, however, you know, the individual might define that, you know, it could be close friends, could be family members, anybody they feel comfortable in sharing information with, they certainly should do so. If it's severe, certainly any medical professional that they're are comfortable in sharing how they're feeling, that they should do that as well, because there are options for medication if needed.
Ray, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast to share your experience. I know it is not the easiest thing to talk about, so I really appreciate you sharing your story and offering advice to our community.
Well, I certainly hope it's helpful to other members of the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Amy, for this month's A Moment for Mental Health segment. And thank you again to Stop the Bleeding for sponsoring this month's A Moment for Mental Health segment. Head on over to stbhemo.com for more. And of course, we can't do the Bloodstream podcast without our presenting sponsor and our founding sponsor, who's also the supporter of Stop the Bleeding, and that is Takeda. And for that, we say,
Thanks, Takeda.
We really do appreciate it. We couldn't do this without you. So, I mean, we're really, really thankful. Moving right into our share segment, we're going to hear this month from a young man named Jerron or Ron Hill from the great state of North Carolina. Ron lives with severe hemophilia B, ADHD, and mild autism, and he has something to say in a piece that he's titled My Personal Experience. Let's give it on over to Ron Hill.
My name is Jerron Craig Hill. I am 22 years old, and I have ADHD, mild autism, and severe hemophilia B. My personal experience within the hemophilia community is as an advocate and participant in the Gen 9 Project Retreat, which is an experiential learning program sponsored by the Coalition for Hemophilia B. Also, I have my own hemophilia walk team called Team Heal. My family and I participate in the Bleeding Disorder 5K and Walk Festival to raise awareness for people with pre-existing medical conditions. As you can tell, the whole hemophilia community is my extended second family. The community means so much to me because they comforted me when I lost my older brother, who passed away in May of 2016. I have a lot of support from the Hemophilia B family when it comes to my personal well-being and safety. When I was 21, I lost insurance coverage. There was no way I could afford my factor. So, the hemophilia community made sure I got everything I needed. Soon afterwards, the community helped enroll me in a free trial. A great team of people helped me through the process of getting factor, and they made me feel very loved. Since then, I have bought my own insurance by myself and feel more safe and secure in my care. The community has done marvelous things for me. I wouldn't have factor if it wasn't for the community support that I have all around me. One piece of advice that I give to you is that you have to advocate for yourself. No one else is going to do it for you. You know you better than anyone else. But with hemophilia, you also have a community of individuals who will have your back and will always be there when you least expect it.
And now for the episode 36 comment segment, a comment segment that's brought to us this month by Breaking Through, the musical and art therapy workshop brought to you by Believe Limited and BioMarin. You may have heard about Breaking Through's workshop and staged performance of Hemophilia the Musical last fall. You may have heard about the soundtrack release on World Hemophilia Day on SoundCloud, Spotify. It's in a few places if you look up the Hemophilia the Musical soundtrack.
Only look it up if you're ready to have tunes stuck in your head all day. They're very catchy.
That is true. But did you know that Breaking Through might soon be coming to you?
What?
That's right. This year, Believe Limited and BioMarin will be executing workshops on the therapeutic value of theatrical and visual arts for teens and young people at patient organization events around the country. To find out if Breaking Through is coming to you, contact your local patient organization leadership. And if you are patient organization leadership who would like to request a Breaking Through workshop, you can email breakingthrough@believeltd.com. That's Breaking Through, T-H-R-O-U-G-H, at Believe, L for Larry, T for Tom, D for David, .com. So the episode 36 comment segment, assisting kids transitioning. It's from HemoWare, the bleeding disorders magazine from NHF. 6 ways to help your kid move to adult care is the name of the article in HemoWare. The article goes through the story of, and I'm going to probably butcher the last name here, but Matt Olovich. So Matt, when he was, the story starts with him at 11 discovering at bleeding disorders camp a desire to want to self-infuse. We learn from his father how the parents always wanted to make sure he wasn't in the passenger seat of his condition. He found baseball and it helped incentivize him to stay compliant to a regimen. Sounds a little bit familiar to me. What else? And then how at 17, he had a major injury, which kind of helped him greater appreciate the need for his care and his independence. So there's a few principles that are in this article that I want to touch on. And then, of course, it uses each of them and it ties it to Matt's story. We'll have a link to the article if you'd prefer to just read this in the program notes. But the big idea is to help the individual build identity, develop agency, and develop comfort. So building in steps towards buy-in. So for example, at what age can you start putting the call with the pharmacy or delivery service for your factor on speakerphone so that you and your child can experience it together, even if you are leading the conversation? At what age can you maybe assist with making the appointments, but they will start going to HTC clinic appointments by themselves? At what age can they start putting away supplies and factor as it is brought into the house, even if they themselves are not doing the ordering? So what are all the different steps that are involved in managing a bleeding disorder? And at what age can you start incorporating another step for your young person?
And I don't think that there's a particular age. I think it's knowing your child and what they can handle individually. But I think that transition, like this article says, and like you're saying, is, you know, making that call to order the factor on speakerphone. And then maybe the next time on speakerphone, you're sitting there and your child talks.
Exactly.
And makes the call. So, like, you know, baby steps where there's like, where it's not just like, all right, I've been doing all these things for you and now you're on your own, making that a transition.
So the article suggests let them practice their communication skills like we're talking about here. How can they start to transition, ordering the factor or making their appointments? Talk about transition milestones well ahead of time. This is just a good thing to do for life. Oneself. You know, it's just like prepare for transitions. Tap into personal motivators. So we kind of teased this a little bit earlier, and this is one that I'm a big fan of. And I was referring to at the Teen Impact Awards as like, you know, maybe you can't quell this individual's experience of anxiety, but you might be able to help them feel supported and loved and honored for something great they did that they didn't think people were paying attention to. In the same way, what are ways that you can excite a young person or yourself? Again, maybe we're talking about you to help you stay compliant. So because it's a low-hanging fruit example, in Bombardier Blood, we go through how baseball really was the thing that helped Chris Bombardier develop a prophylactic routine, help him cope with his needle phobia, help him develop a good self-care practice. And then when baseball went away, those practices started to slip until he found something else that gave him the right motivation, the right incentive. And when parents will ask me sometimes, you know, my kid really wants to play basketball or my kid really wants to do something that's a little bit on the edge, you know, what do you think? Of course, I always give the appropriate disclaimers. I'm not a doctor. I can only give you my experience, da, 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 da. But what I tell them is like, my mom negotiated with me about if I wanted to go play basketball, she would kind of like run down the checklist of what that would mean for me and made sure I was very clear that I was putting myself at risk, that my ankles were compromised, that I could experience bleeding. It could lead to long-term debt. Like she would literally sometimes to like a sitcom comedy like level, as you know, my mom, hi mom. She would just spell it out. And I really appreciated that because she didn't take the choice away from me. But she made it very clear what the potential risks were and what the cost benefit was. But I also, that was my motivation to like want to live a full life. As soon as I was over my inhibitor and on prophy, like I'm enjoying doing this stuff. So even if it hurts me a little bit, like I haven't gotten to do this for a very, very, very long time. So anyway, a little bit of a digression, but finding that personal motivation, finding that reason to want to stay compliant, adherent to your regimen.
And like you'd said too, the identity piece, making sure that your child, your teen who's transitioning does identify as a human with a bleeding disorder so right. That when they go to school, that is a strong part of their identity to stay adherent to their self-care program.
Something that I thought was really interesting that the article pointed out, and we both individually kind of flagged this, was this point here. Let your children's trusted friends get to know you. And Matt's father, Ken, who's a pharmacist too, he mentions, I want to make sure that my kids' friends are comfortable in picking up the phone and calling me. And I'd never really thought about that. But that's that also feels like a smart parent move, bleeding disorder related or otherwise. Yeah, be the parent that other kids would want to call if like stuff's going wrong. Because I want that phone call, right? If I'm the parent, I want you to call me. I want to help. I don't want you to do something stupid to get yourself out of something even, you know, stupider.
One, and with your kids being away at school, getting to know the people that they're spending time with who are their support team away from you.
For sure.
So, you know, that if something, God forbid, goes wrong, that those people feel very comfortable, know your name, know your phone number to reach out to you as a parent to, you know, I think that it's incredibly smart.
And you made a good point in there too, which the article also touches on, which is that for the parents, like this is a transition for them as well. And your child and Ken's point, and Stephanie made this point too, actually, Stephanie Lapido, who's the executive director of the Hemophilia Association of New Jersey. We did a project with young adults and Stephanie last year, and she had said to me at some point, I thought this was very wise, I don't so much care that they connect with the chapter as I do that they're connecting with each other. And Stephanie's point was, I don't need the chapter to be like their beacon and their lighthouse, but I just need to know that they have a support network, that as they're moving through the world, they have one another, they have something. And I thought that was a very mature point of view. And Ken, Matt's dad in this article, kind of reminds me of that when he talks about being you know, someone that those kids can pick up and call, your child or the young person still needs a support network, but you as their parent are, your role in it is changing.
Right.
And there's like, you have to also recognize that as part of it and like try to clock where that might be the driver of some of your behavior or thinking. And maybe it's not about like your child's transition. Maybe part of it is about your transition, you know, and like have the discipline to separate those two thoughts out and treat them each for their individual merits. Cause they're both like, both things are true. That kid's transitioning and you have to get used to like, you're going to have a different relationship to your kid. You know, and as a kid, and when you experience that with your parents, as you go into your 20s and then into your 30s and get married, like your relationship with your parent just keeps evolving.
Sure.
And I don't know. I think sometimes parents don't realize like they have to evolve with it too.
Well, and sometimes the child is super ready for the transition and the parent's not. I mean, when I was a nanny and watching parents drop their kids off at kindergarten for the first time, like some of these kids were ready to launch and it was the parent being like, one more hug, please. And it was like, well, that's when the kid's getting upset because you've just called them back. They were like totally engaged and having a fine time and you called them back for your own needs. So, you know, it is these transitions where there's two sides to the transition. So, and the article does a great job of touching on both sides.
Last point in summary, and then we'll get going here. The article also mentions lean on your HTC for help. So that's a reminder that you do have the Hemophilia Treatment Center. Some of them include a nurse who might be specialized in transitions. The article references Brittany Savage, who has that role for the Indiana Hemophilia and Thrombosis Center. That's not ubiquitous through hemophilia treatment centers, but nonetheless, they are a resource that's there for you to help with the transition, maybe help kind of spitball or tease out solutions to particular challenges or thoughts you're having. Likewise, your local patient organizations, either your HFA member organization or NHF local chapter, the leadership there is also going to be there to help you. So don't be afraid to use the network that you have for support. In the same way that your kid, as they go to college, they're going to be using their network for support. You just hope that network calls you if they ever need it. Yeah, you get the point. We'll have links in the program notes. And again, that is from HemAware, 6 Ways to Help Your Kid Move to Adult Care. And thank you once more to Breaking Through for sponsoring this segment, breakingthroughhemophilia.com, or look up the Hemophilia, the musical soundtrack on Spotify, SoundCloud, or elsewhere. I think we're in a couple other spots too, but Spotify and SoundCloud, that's the easiest.
Mostly.
That's the best ones.
Sure. This month, we have an exciting interview with Dr. Galen Cole. But before we get to that, I would like to let you know that today's interview segment is brought to us by the Empowering Women series. This year, for Bleeding Disorders Awareness Month, Bloodstream Media released a special 3-episode series titled Empowering Women. Since 1999, a group of women with bleeding and clotting disorders have been gathering in Texas for a weekend of education, relaxation, and connection. In this podcast series, we take a close look at how the retreat has evolved over the last 20 years, breaking the journey down into 3 parts, from uniting to believing to empowering women. This 3-episode series is now available by clicking on the Empowering Women tab on the BloodstreamMediaPod.com.
BloodstreamPod.com.
Sure, I always call it different things. But if you're trying to find it on the internet, it is bloodstreampod.com.
That's where we would primarily recommend you go.
Yeah. If you type in the other things, who knows where that'll take you?
I have a guess.
I mean, hopefully not something strange.
DNS search error. This domain's available for $50 million. I want that job where you just like squat on domains and you're like $50,000 and like cross your fingers. I guess it's working for some people.
For some people, yeah.
So Dr. Galen Cole, this month's interview segment guest. Who is Dr. Galen Cole, a.k.a. Dr. Galen? Well, Dr. Galen is a licensed counselor, board-certified psychotherapist, a certified clinical hypnotherapist, and a traumatologist with over 40 years' experience. He holds 3 masters and a PhD, has published several books and scientific papers, and has taught at various universities. In addition to his practice, his research, writing, and academic work, Dr. Galen has also been on staff or consulted with the World Health Organization, the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF, the Navajo Nation, China Centers for Disease Control, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, where he served as a research psychologist and director of research and evaluation activities for various departments. Lastly, he can be seen on the Learning Channel, TLC's television show, The seven little Johnsons. And he's been married to his wife, Priscilla, for 43 years. They have five grown children and numerous grandchildren. So I asked Dr. Galen to come on to discuss cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which we brought up on a recent A Moment for Mental Health segment, and to speak more broadly about what's known as positive psychology. Dr. Galen is clearly an expert who shares a wide range of information about positive psychology, CBT, and much more. So let's take a listen to this month's interview with Dr. Galen Cole. Okay, joining me now for the interview is Dr. Galen Cole. Dr. Galen, how are you?
Good. How about yourself, Patrick?
We're in the chair. I'm doing well, thanks. Actually, just came from a psychodynamic therapy session, so I feel like I'm well primed for this conversation.
Well, good.
So to get us started, I found my way to you, as we were just talking about off mic, through your work and specialty in CBT. But as if I'm understanding correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that's kind of part of a broader positive psychology methodology that you subscribe to or belong to. So can you talk me through and talk our listeners through what is positive psychology and how might it differ from traditional psychology or what people might think when they think psychology?
Okay, great question. As you are probably aware, psychology has been evolving rapidly over the past 50, 60, 70 years. Traditionally, psychology focused on a disease model, that is, what's wrong with people. And 60, 70 years ago, it was mostly smoke and mirrors. The behaviorists like B.F. Skinner and J.B. Watson and Joseph Wolpe and others, even Ivan Pavlov, contributed to this idea that we needed to bring science to psychology, and that resulted in a lot of great things, because we learned to, through science, classify disorders and measure those orders with a lot of rigor. And that evolved into what is now the DSM. We're in the fifth iteration of the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that people like me use to classify a disorder that somebody meets criteria for. Anyway, along the way, we realized that we were focusing only on people that needed repaired, and we weren't applying psychology to help normal people improve their lives. And along came people like Martin Seligman, who really is the father of positive psychology in the United States, or probably has claim to that title worldwide. And he said that we need to be as concerned about human strength as we are about human weakness. And so positive psychology became a science of looking at what makes life worth living. And a lot of the studies, and Seligman and his group at University of Pennsylvania have done copious amounts of science and looked at, whereas we looked at what made people with mental disorders different than the rest of the population, they started looking at what made exceptional people different from the rest of the population. And out of that came all kinds of wonderful things that have influenced what is my primary focus, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. And if you like, I can actually walk you through some of the history that ties all that together, because it really has tied neatly into cognitive therapy, whereas we used to look at, as we did assessments, just the problems. We're now looking at life satisfaction, well-being, self-esteem, self-confidence, and variables like those.
I think a lot of people listening to this podcast will appreciate that. We talk often within bleeding disorders about the value of the integrated model and what comprehensive care means when it comes to managing and optimizing your quality of life when you have a chronic condition. So I think there'll be a lot of appreciation for what you just said. And to answer your question, yeah, it would be great to hear a little of the history behind how cognitive behavior behavioral therapy was developed out of this school of thinking, because it does seem like cognitive behavioral therapy is something being discussed more and more often in 2019 than perhaps 5-10 years ago. So that history would be very valuable.
So just as a kind of a 50,000 foot view, cognitive behavioral therapy is, the acronym is CBT. And it's really an umbrella term that refers to psychotherapies that focus on how beliefs and thoughts impact how we feel and what we do. And at this point in history, we're in the third iteration or the third wave of what I call the cognitive and behavioral movement. And that movement started in the mid-50s with Albert Ellis, who created what's called rational motive therapy. And Ellis was a genius. He was top 10% of Mensa and kind of an unusual kid, and loved to read about ancient philosophy. And his favorite philosophy was Stoicism. And he took a lot of the ideas from Stoicism and built the foundation of what was rational motive therapy that became cognitive behavioral therapy. So just as an aside, something that's trending in businesses across the country and in professional athletic circles like the NFL is Stoicism. A lot of the famous Stoics, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, wrote down their philosophy, and those have been resurrected. So many times people that come to me for CBT also have kind of an introduction through Stoicism, and they see the connection, and that really provides a foundation. Whether you're starting with CBT or starting with Stoicism, you can make the connection and get lots and lots of rich wisdom from thousands of years ago. So all of that is to say, even though I'm going to start in the mid-50s, this is an ancient philosophy that's benefited from the science over the past 65, 70 years. In the mid-50s, along came Ellis, and he started this rational motive therapy, and was also able to benefit from behaviorism, which I mentioned earlier, which really emphasized science. And then about 3 years later, Aaron Beck at University of Pennsylvania created what was called cognitive therapy. And they, if you put them side by side, it's like looking at a Big Mac versus a Whopper. They both have meat, buns, tomatoes, lettuce, pickles, but they call them different things. And so the emphasis of that second wave CBT or cognitive therapy, as it was called at the time, was the idea that people had these distorted beliefs, and that whenever they were activated by some type of stress and illness, somebody cuts you off in traffic, you're in an argument with someone you love, we get activated, and we are activated in very oversized ways, because these distorted beliefs amplify the stress we're already feeling. And some of those, for example, are most of them are coming out of childhood. But some examples of these irrational beliefs are, I'm not good enough, I'll never be good enough, life must be fair, I must be competent, I must always be upset when I do bad things, and so on. So the idea was, and it was a theory at the time, those distorted beliefs caused us to behave in unhelpful ways. And if we could change those beliefs, we could affect behavior. Fortunately, at the same, not long after that, a couple decades actually after that, neuroscientists started demonstrating that practicing thinking in new ways caused a rewiring of the brain because of brain plasticity. So CBT in the second wave kind of benefited from neuroscience and all that we've learned about neuroplasticity, and then took a very large step forward when we joined forces with Zen, which is a particular type of Buddhism, and added the concept of what we call mindfulness. So the third wave of CBT is commonly referred to as mindful cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's a very specific kind of mindfulness. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, is kind of how that works. If you're interested, I think that's probably enough history. The point of it is, we've got this modern evidence-based psychotherapy called mindful cognitive behavioral therapy, and it's informed by ancient philosophies, Buddhism and Stoicism. And the reason we're probably talking about CBT and you're seeing it all over the place is there's literally been thousands of studies done, random controlled trial studies that demonstrate that it's effective. If you do a baseline on somebody who's got depression, for example, and then you do a standard course of CBT, which is often about 12 sessions, and you do a follow-up assessment, people who get CBT compared to other psychotherapies typically always win. In other words, they get better. They have more positive emotions and so forth. So because of healthcare costs, because science is reigns when it comes to healthcare, CBT continues to gain prominence.
That's really interesting. It's neat to hear that history from Stoicism and then the benefits of scientific developments, and then another philosophical principle being implemented in this third wave, kind of as mile markers for how it's developed. That's helpful framing and interesting to think about. And it does serve as a reminder that while this might be something that people like me are hearing about more in the last few years, so it feels new, it's actually rooted in things that have been around for a very long time, and it's benefited from evolutions in science and philosophy over time as well. So to your point, yes, it'd be great to hear more about the mindfulness component in particular. And I'm wondering too, if this ties together, this might be two separate questions, but you referenced, you know, experiences from childhood. And I was wanting to get into talk of trauma and developmental trauma as opposed to at large trauma. I don't know how to categorize the alternative. But maybe if you could talk a little about the role of trauma, and how cognitive behavioral therapy interacts with trauma as well.
Okay. Well, that throws a caveat in everything. Trauma is, we're still trying to understand it. I guess the thing that, I'm 65 years old now, and if people look back and ask what I contributed, it's probably the fact that I've tied together the three waves of CBT with what's called the trans-theoretical model of mindful cognitive behavioral therapy. That's a mouthful, but in my field, to get prominent, sometimes we have to use mouthfuls. So I've tied the three waves together. I go around the country training psychotherapists to use the third wave. And one of the issues in teaching CBT is it has some weaknesses as it relates to treating trauma. So just kind of in a very simple way, when we're conceptualizing problems from a CBT perspective, the mindful part is, I call it intervention specific. I teach people to be aware of their status. What are your problems, and what's your level of resilience, and what are your susceptibilities? For example, if I asked you, Patrick, what's your status on a scale of 1 to 10? 10, you've never been better. 1, you've never been worse. If you told me, well, I'm a 4, 3, 2, 1, around there, I'm on the lower end of the scale, I would say you probably need to take a nap, shut down for a little bit, instead of going and asking your boss for a raise or having a big argument with your spouse or doing something like figuring out the problems you haven't been able to figure out up to this point in your life. So being mindful of how you're doing, and the positive psychology there is, I ask, whereas I used to just ask about problems and all that stuff, we start asking about resilience and really teaching the importance of building resilience and being attentive to whether or not you're resilient or vulnerable. If you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired, sick, you're vulnerable. Take it easy. Don't try to conquer the world. You can build resilience and strength, but it takes time and you can't run faster than you're able. In addition to that, in the very first part of all this, we ask people, what do you want in life? What do you want to be, do, get, experience in life? And from that point on, once you've told me that, I can say that anything you think and do to get rid of the pain caused by your problems that doesn't help you get what you want is irrational. So one neat part of CBT is we're agreeing, if you give us your credit card and it works, we agree to help you get what you want. The second part of it, after I've helped you be mindful of your status, and all this is leading to your question about trauma. So we teach people to be mindful of activating events or triggers. I call them problems. And problems are discrepancies between the way you think things should be and the way they are. And a Zen principle that we apply there is acceptance. Accept that life is filled with problems. Accept that you are who you are and you have whatever you have. And as soon as you do that, you quit fighting reality and you start to deal with what is real. And at that stage, we help people start to differentiate between self-induced problems and life events, things we don't have control over. The important part of activating events or problems or triggers is they create stress, which is putting pressure on us. And the moment we experience pressure, our brain does this appraisal. It's called a cognitive appraisal. It asks us, is what just happened to me dangerous? Is it related to my goals? If we answer yes to either one of those, then we go into a second level and we ask ourselves, can I cope with it? If the answer to that is no, we ask ourselves, can I find somebody to help me? If the answer to that is no, then we have this very difficult response. We start to panic. We start to experience lots of cortisol in the blood. Typically, people come to therapists like me when they get to that place where they feel like something's going on, they can't cope with it, and they're hoping that somebody like me can help them. So to just summarize, I'm teaching people to be mindful of how they're doing, their problems, the amount of stress they're experiencing, which is relevant to the entire process. And then this appraisal that I just talked about is where stoicism and cognitive therapy comes in. Most people aren't aware of the appraisal, and it happens in the context of life experiences. And if we've had some trauma as a kid or even as an adult, when you're activated, that appraisal is very different than it is if you had a healthy upbringing. You didn't have developmental trauma. Your parents knew how to parent. Everything went kind of well. You're not being affected by that. So after that appraisal, whether it's a good, accurate appraisal or one that's very distorted, which is often the case when people are struggling emotionally, people start feeling things. They feel emotional and physical pain. And then they start thinking things and doing things to get rid of the pain. And so we think of this in terms of an ABC model. The A is the activating event, the problem. The B is the interpretation of the event. And the C is the consequence, how we feel and what we think about to get rid of the pain. So positive psychology has added this feature, which is, hey, ask people what they really want in life. And then when they tell you what they want, you can tell them anytime you think things, tell yourself stories or do things that prevent you from getting what you want. That's irrational. That's maladaptive. And then our techniques help people change those maladaptive ways of thinking and acting. All of that is fine and good until a person has trauma. And what trauma does is when people are activated at A, they're dealing with whatever's happening in the moment, which could be a health problem, a health emergency, and that trauma starts playing in the background. And so somebody who's got an unresolved trauma, unprocessed trauma, which is a subcortical memory that's kind of laying there in the emotional part of the brain, they're not only dealing with life like the rest of us are, they're also dealing with that thing that happened, could have been decades ago. And so you'll see those individuals have what we call oversized responses. For example, people who have trauma can't differentiate between a simple observation and a value judgment. So if you say to them, hey, when you do the wash, separate the whites from the colors, they hear you saying, you're such an idiot, you can't even do the wash, even though you've done it thousands of times, and then they explode. So that's a thing that most people aren't seeing. The way CBT normally dealt with it was with a technique called cognitive processing. In the past 15 years, we've identified very effective techniques. Cognitive processing was just trying to talk through the trauma and reframe it. The new techniques like EMDR and brain spotting and some of the tapping techniques, which are easily identified online if you Google treatments for trauma, are very powerful and can resolve those traumas sometimes in two or three sessions. So I'll include some of this and I'll send it to you that you included in the program notes.
Please, yeah, that'd be great.
So the question was, you wanted to know about, I think, two different types of trauma. One was developmental trauma. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in what you've just said, but with regard to, trauma, I guess one of the concepts that's been intriguing to me is the idea of developmental trauma, traumas that are occurring in childhood or while the brain is still forming, and how those can be more, maybe for lack of a better word, severe when we play out the tape of one's life than traumas later in life. But of course, both can have a great impact on one's general state of wellness. I was just curious to hear in your experience, do you agree with that? And what are your thoughts on that?
So there's lots and lots of theories about this. One of the beauties of cognitive behavioral therapy is the behaviorist said, there's this thing called the black box, which is the mind. You can't see inside the black box, but you can say they're acting like they're thinking what? Along came the cognitive people and they said, oh yeah, we can find out what's in the black box. We can say, hey, what are you thinking? And what's happened to you? So we get to trauma very quickly. It's not this long drawn out psychoanalysis, what drives are not being met. It's through these very rigorous assessments, we can identify symptoms of trauma, flashbacks, nightmares, insomnia, loss of interest in life, anger, all that stuff. And then we can bring these tools to the process or to the problem very quickly. And our the two tools that are evidence-based now that everybody's using are cognitive processing and EMDR. And so all that's to say that there's probably some controversy. If you talk to 10 CBT therapists, you're going to maybe get six different answers. We're still working it out. But the fact that we've identified how to get to the subcortical brain through EMDR and brain spotting is a remarkable discovery that's revolutionizing the treatment of trauma. So specific to trauma, there's probably the developmental stuff that when a kid, so maybe I'll start with the big stuff. If you have, you lose a loved one, you lose a beloved animal, suddenly you have a car wreck, you're in a fire, any of those big things, an earthquake, some people, not all, not most, some people have a memory that's causing them to be stuck. And we think that that memory is in the wrong part of the brain, probably near the amygdala or the emotional brain, the limbic brain. And so just talking to someone can't access that memory. Through EMDR and brain spotting, you can use the eyes to access, because of the way the optic nerves cross the emotional brain and the proximity there, you can access trauma through the eyes. And you can very quickly get somebody dysregulated around that specific trauma that's been playing for who knows how long. And they can process it very quickly. So I'm losing myself. I might have gone down a rabbit hole. I want to make sure that I'm on track.
I think that was very, I mean, that's very, just to feedback what I've just heard, though, that I think is very useful. And it's something that, frankly and honestly, I contend with, is an idea of, is there something affecting me that I don't even consciously understand or recall? Is there something that is buried away somewhere? That's something I'm actively kind of working on and thinking about and curious about. I don't think I'm different from many other people in that way. So that's very interesting. I'm glad you shared that.
It's so important that all of my intakes involve assessing whether or not there's an unresolved trauma. And what I've discovered over the past few years, as I've become an expert in this, is that a lot of the people that are showing up with depression, or especially anxiety, who are being diagnosed by psychiatrists and with all kinds of disorders, because a psychiatrist is seeing this cross-section. I mean, they use assessments and they try to get a comprehensive view, but many times they hear these about these symptoms and they see this cross-section and they label the person. When I see them and spend time with them, I realize what they're seeing is not an actual disorder. It's simply trauma playing out in the background. And as soon as we go after and treat that specific trauma, all the symptoms resolve. So all that's to say, I'm very excited about the new trauma treatments, EMDR, brain spotting, and I'm excited about the evolution of CBT and how it's incorporated mindfulness. And there's so many good things happening in the field. We've gone in 60, 70 years from kind of smoke and mirrors to really starting to get an idea of what's driving illness and what's creating an optimal life, and understanding how to use very effective tools to take somebody not from just resolving their symptoms, but to a happy, healthy, well state. And that's another important factor in all this, is we've gone from, our goal was, the problem was symptoms, and the goal was symptom resolution. The goal now is healing.
Which is a paradigm shift, right? That is a not so subtle distinction. So I'm curious to know, I was in a room recently with a number of adult men with hemophilia. So it's a group of adult men with a chronic disease, many of whom have other co-infections because they've lived through a time when contaminated blood product resulted in their contracting hepatitis and/or HIV. Some have cleared the hepatitis, some have not. Some have lost friends. Most experience some form of chronic pain daily. So this is a population that's tested. And it came up, how many people here are feel as though they experience prolonged periods of a depressed mood? And then someone defined major depressive disorder, and you know, how many hands, and still a lot of hands in the air. And then they asked again, how many people here have ever thought about or contemplated suicide in any way? And there were a lot of hands in the air. And I'm curious, you mentioned earlier, you said, I forget the context exactly, but you had said, you know, by the time somebody gets to me, and it made me wonder, where do people usually go before they find their way to you? Your work is clearly very well informed and a merge of different concepts and philosophies over time and well-tested and articulated and defined. I imagine people struggle for a long time often before they find their way to you. So I guess what I'm driving at is, for that average adult male in that room who had their hand up for any number of those questions that were asked, who are experiencing some form of mental and emotional distress as it relates to their being an adult man with hemophilia and all that comes with it, what would be the most important thing you could say to that person if you had 2-3 minutes of time with them? What direction could you send that person in?
I would say, I would validate that, wow, this can be tough, and my heart goes out. I know it's hard. It's accepting what you have, and saying, you know what? I'm not going to say, yay, I have this. I'm going to say, I'm going to be peaceful about this, and I feel what I focus on. So what do I need to start focusing on to feel peace? The most popular cognitive distortion or irrational core belief across all continents is life must be fair. In fact, people like Nick Vujicic, the person without arms and legs, goes around the world talking about, hey, I have no arms and legs, but I'm happy. I go skydiving. I have a surfboard. I have a song on VH1. I'm a multimillionaire. I'm married. I've got 2 kids. I have no arms and legs. The point is, if we can accept what is, that's probably one of the most powerful interventions that we have. And then say, you know what? I'm going to set some goals and I'm going to move towards those goals. And I'm going to change my focus towards whatever I need to focus on to make me feel the way I want to feel. And I want to feel peaceful. And the miraculous discovery there is that neuroscience says if you practice focusing on a new direction, and you do so repeatedly, because of synaptic pruning, your old neural pathway that made the negative thoughts automatic is eliminated, and you create this new neural pathway that causes this new optimistic, positive focus to be an automatic focus, and then you're off, and you can do what you're sent here to do, fulfill your potential.
It reminds me of in sports or in theater, you perform the way you rehearse, you play the way you practice. That process oriented, if you work your way towards something, then when you get there, it's the culmination of your working toward it. So if you reconfigure the synapses, if you're firing in new directions, if you're building new neural pathways and others are not being treaded quite so often, it's the same principle that maybe many of us have actualized physically through theater or through sports. It feels like sometimes the brain is ill-served because we think of it as something a little more foreign than other aspects of health. We treat mental and behavioral health differently. Insurance reimburses for it differently. It's put into this like other box. And it's all just a part of the one thing that we came into the world operating. It's all one thing. So it's actually not that surprising when you break it down that way, that of course you can retrain your brain to process things that are more in line with that feelings goal or whatever your goal may be. You have the agency to choose that goal and the ability to move toward it. But I don't know. I feel like maybe we just don't believe that that's true on some level without someone like you presenting it in so irrefutable a way, if that makes sense.
And I'm sure most of the listeners aren't scientists. The remarkable thing that we've been able to do is do neuroimaging and look at the way the brain fires in response to a certain stimulus. If you have a negative event, you'll have a specific pathway that fires. And that typically, if you're depressed, starts creating this negative thinking. And if you do this standard course of CBT and cause people to change their focus, first of all, accept and then change, and they practice it, you'll, and you do a follow-up image, you'll see the process fire down a different pathway. The brain literally rewires itself. And it's like you said, with physical health, if you want to learn how to skateboard, the first time you get on the skateboard, you're not going to be good at it. But if you continue to practice, it becomes automatic. And that's the same way with unhealthy thinking. Many people have just thought themselves into a hole. And I should say, when we change our thinking, we have something called cognitive dissonance. You can do great things. And maybe the greatest thing you can do is be peaceful.
I really like that. We're coming up on our time, and I want to talk to you about the Seven Little Johnsons on TLC before we wrap. But I do have one question before we get to that. I was in looking through your materials online, prepping for our conversation today. One thing that jumped out to me, you have multiple degrees. You've been honored by two of the universities that you've graduated from. You've got a boatload of experience. Your presentations list on your website is quite long. But I was impressed by how often your reference to your experience in your marriage and in your family came up. And I thought that says something about a practitioner who is fronting how in his own life, this enriching part of it, he feels compelled to share that as part of his professional face, so to speak, at least digitally. That struck me. And I think it says something about one's character to choose to do that. And so I'm curious to know, to what degree has your experience in your marriage and in your family influenced the way that you think about these things and ultimately treat your patients?
So I've been married for 45 years. My wife and I have raised 6 kids. A good way to sum that up is we've been there, done that. One of our children has bipolar disorder, and we've had all kinds of exciting, I put that in air quotes, exciting experiences. And so it's easy to kind of learn this material and talk the talk, but when you come home, you got to walk the talk. And that's been the most valuable part of all this, is I've been able to apply it in my personal life and help my kids. And kind of my secret weapon has been my wife, Priscilla. She's not a psychologist. She's an accountant and a developer. But she understands psychology. It's just came natural to her that to help people, you have to connect with them. So on top of in CBT, another important therapeutic factor is we accept people unconditionally. And she really taught me how to do that. And my kids, of course, I don't know if you've raised kids or not, but at the end of the day, you're just kind of like, I hope they're all alive. So yeah, that's been a great, great journey. I've got a lot of miles on me, and they're good miles. We have 5 grandkids. And so it continues.
Dr. Galen, I've really enjoyed this conversation and could speak with you about this topic at great length. Can you tell us a little bit about where people can? So we'll have links in our program notes for interacting with Dr. Galen's work. But can you also share with us a little bit? I know that you work with Trent Johnson of the Seven Little Johnsons, which airs on TLC. For context, this episode will go live May 20th. So you were mentioning to me earlier that there's some upcoming episodes that you'll be a part of. So maybe you could share a little bit about where generally people can interact with your work, and specifically the appearances on TLC.
Okay, I worked in Hollywood for a number of years as a content consultant. Recently, I've been, you'll see me in 5 episodes so far in the Little Johnstons doing CBT and couples therapy. I think it airs next Tuesday, which is April 30th. I'm not sure when this program airs, at 10 p.m. Eastern time. So yeah, if people want to follow up and see how I do this in person, I'd love to have you join in. Also have written some books, which you can access on my website, GalenCole, GalenCole.com. One of them talks about my work in Hollywood. It's called Life Script Restructuring, and it's based on cognitive therapy and how you can use it to change your life script and become a different person.
Well, Dr. Galen, again, thank you for the time today. I think a lot of valuable things came up that will be of interest to our listeners. And thank you for the work you do as someone who believes in it and benefits from it. I appreciate you've dedicated your career to this. So thank you.
Thank you, Patrick, and all the best to you and all the listeners. Have a great evening.
You as well. Bye-bye.
Now moving into Mama Sue's Netflix Directs, although one more time I want to recognize our presenting sponsor for making the Bloodstream podcast possible, Takeda. Thanks, Takeda. And now over to Mama Sue with this month's streaming recommendations, Mama Sue's Netflix Directs. Hi, Mom.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Glad we're in May. I'm glad the weather's turned. I hear even in New York it's resembling something that seems livable.
Yes, spring is in the air.
How is spring in Stewart Manor?
It was rainy yesterday, but it's coming along. You know, we're feeling the spring. Yeah, it's nice now. Today's very nice.
So we've got some different suggestions. You've deviated a little bit from some of your interest in organized crime and about what we shouldn't be eating anymore. We've spread our wings a little bit this month. So maybe let's start with I'm looking at The Highwaymen here. So maybe let's start there. Tell us about The Highwaymen.
Okay, The Highwaymen I saw on Netflix. It's with Kevin Costner, Woody Harrelson, and Kathy Bates. And what it's about the two ex-Texas Rangers that brought down Bonnie and Clyde. And the show is completely about them. And apparently in the early 1900s, the Texas Rangers had been disbanded. Kathy Bates is the governor of the town in Texas, and they were disbanded, I think, because more elite lawmen were being trained, the FBI and elite police officers. And these were kind of thought as just kind of rough country bumpkin types. So Bonnie and Clyde had been on the rampage for a couple of years. There were hundreds of FBI on the road trying to bring them down, and they couldn't bring them down. And someone from the Texas Rangers who used to work with the character of Kevin Costner, I think his name was Frank, and Woody Harrelson's character brought their names up. And Kathy Bates, you know, she says, oh my God, what were those two? Forget those two, blah, blah, blah. The long story short, the movie is completely about these two and the search for Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde have very little to do with the movie, believe it or not. It's very interesting. You actually don't see their faces until they have been shot dead at the end of the movie. You see them dead. But it's just the whole journey of finding them. And like with a lot of people who are criminals, there's a certain element of us who kind of look up to them. And a lot of the general public were cheering Bonnie and Clyde and wanted them not to get caught because they were robbing mostly banks and wealthy people, like Robin Hood types. They weren't going after the poor, and so many people were poor then. So I liked it. I thought Kevin Costner was fantastic. He was having a very nice gentleman's life. He had married a lady with some money, and his name is Frank in the movie. Woody Harrelson was down on his luck, and he's fantastic in the movie. And it's semi-biographical, and I just think people would find it interesting. I did.
It's available on Netflix. It looks like it premiered in Austin, Texas during South by Southwest earlier this year. And as of April, it's been now on Netflix. Yeah, those are some, you mentioned powerhouse actors, and Woody Harrelson in particular is somebody that I'm always a big fan of.
Yes.
Okay, so that's nice, The Highwaymen. And I like those stories that are kind of one degree to the side of the story that you know. Of course, I'm struggling to think of examples off the top of my head, but the idea that Bonnie and Clyde are the story engine for why we're meeting these two characters, but these are two characters that otherwise have been lost to history. You would have no reason to know them.
Exactly.
It's cool when stories kind of just shift the spotlight over 5 degrees and there's a whole, bunch of stories over here that you had no idea about. Next up, we have the Mayo Clinic. So tell us about the Mayo Clinic.
Oh, the Mayo Clinic was very interesting. I mean, I'm sure there's not an American adult in this country and in most other countries that when the Mayo Clinic is mentioned, they're not like, oh, wow, yes, yes, they revere it. We all revere it. It's just amazing, the humble beginnings in the late 1800s. This Dr. Mayo, he was in Minnesota. And back then, there really was no special training for doctors, but he was one of the better self-trained ones. And he was an agnostic or an atheist, I forget which, and he teamed up with these nuns of St. Francis, these six nuns, and he wanted to build, the nuns wanted to build a hospital with him, and they raised all the money. Back in the day, I think the land was $7,000 and the building was $40,000, which was an awful lot of money back then. And they built this little six-bed hospital, and the nurses gave up all their beds. And these nuns were not even trained nurses. They were teachers. So they did the cooking, the cleaning. They took care of the patients, and they had no training. And very few times was there any problems that anyone died. Down the road, as it expanded, they hired a nurse to teach the nuns how to be nurses. But it was just so interesting how this was the first hospital that was open to all people. And you paid due to your ability to pay. If you didn't have money, you didn't pay. And he actually, Dr. Mayo, he mortgaged his house for $600 to buy a microscope for the hospital. And starting back then, up to this day, people come to the Mayo Clinic to observe and learn. And it was the first hospital that had doctors on staff, which I thought was interesting. Because up till then, and even a lot of times today, the more patients you see, the more money you make. In the Mayo Clinic back then and today, all are on salary. And there's 2,400 doctors affiliated with the Mayo Clinic. There's satellites all around the world, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the documentary is so interesting. I highly recommend it.
So it looks like it's a PBS doc that was made by Ken Burns, who's a renowned.
Ken Burns, once again, he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, he doesn't disappoint. Where did you watch this?
This was on... I believe it was Amazon, yeah. And they also developed medical records where when they would treat a patient, they would take notes and put them aside. So if the patient came in again, someone who was working could review them. And of course, we have medical records today. They were the first to have, as the years went on, computers in the operating room. It just goes on and on how many firsts Dr. Mayo had. And both his sons went into medicine. And what they did, because they had amassed so much money, even though, you know, they were a very serving group of doctors, they turned all their money over to the Mayo Clinic and put themselves on a small salary because they didn't think that they should be having all this money, that it had to go back to the hospital. So,
well, you know what's neat about that, too, is I couldn't have told you why the Mayo Clinic is the Mayo Clinic. Like you said, you say it and adults go, oh, yeah, Mayo Clinic. But I couldn't really have told you why, other than like, it's a great hospital. So it's
right.
It's interesting that this is actually taking the time to examine why it's become this kind of backbone of the American healthcare system. It's one of the institutions I think we're most proud of.
They were the first to sterilize instruments when they put together that, you know, germs and bacteria are not visible to the naked eye, but they're there. And it's funny because in 1986, this St. Mary's Hospital merged fully with the Mayo Clinic, only in 1986. So when the lawyers approached the head nun, I forget her name, and said, well, where's your contracts and your documents from your longstanding business relationship? And she said, we have no contracts. We have no documents. And the lawyer couldn't believe it. He goes, how have you been together all these years without anything legal? She said, we did it on a handshake. Well, what did you do when there was problems and disagreements? She said, we worked them out. And the lawyer said to her, well, you're going to put us all out of business. And she said, good.
All right. Well, then last but certainly not least, the Secrets of Selfridges. I know all about this one, but tell our audience the Secrets of Selfridges.
Yes, because you watched this one with me. Harry Selfridge is an American who in the early 1900s, came from very poor beginnings with his single mother. And he was from, I believe, Wisconsin. And he worked for Marshall Fields, had done some business trips for Marshall Fields over to England, which was the main fashion spot at the time. And he decided that he was going to build a department store in England because they didn't have department stores. And back in the day in England, you went to a store not to browse or touch or look. You went to buy something. Everything was behind the counter. You went in. If you wanted gloves, gloves were taken from the case and shown to you, and you took those gloves. So he wanted people to browse. He wanted all types of people to shop together. And today, Selfridges is the most famous store in the world. It still exists. And so many things that we do today, as you remember from the show, the customer's always right. That was Selfridge, Harry Selfridge. Every department store you walk into, all the fragrance and makeup is in the front. That was Harry Selfridge. And he was very pro-woman. He paid his staff more money than usual so they could live off-site, because most of the staff back in the day in the early 1900s were like slaves. They were just living on the property in a horrible condition. So he paid them more money. He had high expectations. But also, he was, if you recall, he was the first to put female bathrooms in stores. If you were a woman and you had to go to the bathroom when you were out, you had to go home. Isn't that bizarre? And also back then, women didn't really go out. This was the first time women could go out. Women went out escorted by a man. And it wasn't very often you did go out. So this way a woman could, you know, go out, with take a bus or have a driver take her to the store and spend the day. He also was the first one to have ready-made clothes. Prior to that, you had to, you know, buy a material and bring them to a seamstress. And he didn't have a very happy ending to his life. He got involved with gambling and...
Yeah, there's some unfortunate twists in his story. And that was something that jumped out to me, that he kind of revolutionized pre-made clothes, as opposed to... It's such a thing now that, you know, we think about ordering clothes from Amazon based on our sizes. It's so far removed from only 100 years ago, where he purchased the fabric and there was a design and a seamstress was involved, and it was a whole...
Right.
It was a whole process. So...
If anyone can get over to England, to Oxford Street, it's still there.
You can tweet at us or send us a picture over here at the Bloodstream Podcast. We'll make sure to feature it. I'll make sure Mom sees it. So we've got The Highwaymen and The Secrets of Selfridges, both of which are available on Netflix. And then the Ken Burns PBS documentary, The Mayo Clinic, which you mentioned is available on Amazon.
Yes.
All right. Well, those are three great suggestions for this week. Anything else you want to let our listeners know before you go? And anything else going on with Mama Sue?
No, nothing really. I'm not sure what I'm going to watch now for next month, but I'll try to, you know, keep it diverse.
Well, we appreciate it. We appreciate you keeping us posted on what's out there. There's a lot to watch. We can't all watch all of it. So it's good that you're doing,
right.
You're doing some good work out there for us all, Mom.
Oh, thank you, darling.
Thanks as always.
All right. Bye-bye.
And now I will kick it over to Believe creative director Ryan Geelan, who will be leading us through a special segment on the Teen Impact Awards, the fifth annual Teen Impact Awards. Take it away, Ryan.
Welcome, everybody.
You guys ready for tonight?
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Teen Impact Awards.
The fifth annual Teen Impact Awards honors teens affected by bleeding disorders who are making a positive impact in their homes, schools, or communities. Held on the opening night of NHF's Bleeding Disorders Conference, or BDC, the Teen Impact Awards is proud to honor inspiring community teens and siblings from all across the country.
I want to be a part of, like, the end of just childhood illness.
This world needs more kindness.
I'm pretty sure everyone in this room, or almost everyone in this room, has felt a time where they give up. You're going to get over it. You're going to get through it, and you're going to strive to do, like, the best that you can do.
The submission process is fun and easy. Teens, siblings, parents, advocates, chapter leaders, clinicians can all nominate community teens making a positive impact in any of our official categories: academics, advocacy, arts and athletics, leadership, and service. Last year, we honored 70 teens from 30 different states, and every teen who attended was brought up on stage to talk about their efforts to make an impact.
I was learning how to infuse myself for the first time, and a couple of my friends were there. They were pumping me up to do it so that way I didn't have to worry about it.
The hemophilia community is such a strong and resilient group of people.
Don't waste your time sitting around. Get involved. You will not regret it.
Teens don't have to attend in order to be honored. We always make the video of the event available afterwards. The ceremony is hosted by Patrick, who you know is one of the hosts of this podcast, and features tons of community guest hosts. Last year, guest hosts included Mountaineer Chris Bombardier, NFL Super Bowl champion Josh Gordy, and members of the National Youth Leadership Institute, or NYLI. So if you know of teens in your area who are doing impactful work to support their families, their teammates, their schools, their churches, their communities in some meaningful way, nominate them. We want to show the world that bleeding disorders can't hold us back, and we want to honor those teens who are leading by example.
The more you share your stories, the more personable you are, and it makes a bigger impact on the community.
The people that have helped me have inspired me to give back because I have learned so much and become a much better person and the person that I am today because of this community.
We've honored teens who helped younger kids overcome their fear of self-infusing. We've honored teens who got high GPAs while helping their parents launch their first small business. We've honored teens who raised thousands and thousands of dollars for their chapter's walks. If a teen with a bleeding disorder is just out there crushing it, inspiring others, and showing the world what we can do, nominate them. The official website is www.teenimpactawards.com. Just click nominate when you get there. The nomination form is simple and clear. Nominations are open now and close June 28th at midnight Pacific. Questions? Check out our very comprehensive FAQ on the website. I know it's good because I wrote it myself. Again, the website is www.teenimpactawards.com and nominations are officially open. See you in Anaheim at NHF's Bleeding Disorders Conference.
Before wrapping up episode 36 of the Bloodstream Podcast, as always, we have a parting shot, one last little bit to leave you with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise. Before we call it a day, before we call it a May, before we call it, I have nothing else for you. Natalie, what do you have for us as a parting shot?
Well, May, like I said before, is Mental Health Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it's a really good month to check in and see what you're doing for your self-care and maybe take a day or, you know, do something that's a little bit outside of what you would normally do. This month, I am returning back to Vipassana for a little tune-up, if you will.
I like the way you say I'm returning back. It sounds like an athlete who's like coming back, or maybe I'm just in basketball playoffs mode, but it's like coming back from Cleveland, Ohio.
Natalie Rose to Vipassana. 3 days of silence. Can
but
she
do really
it?
A really exciting ramp up to it. A really vibrant, loud, noisy, talkative ramp up.
I mean, the thing is, we are recording this 4 hours before I get in the car and leave to enter No Technology in Silence till Friday. So, you know, I am trying to ramp. This is my hype. I'm hyping myself up on the podcast for everyone to hear, but
getting all your talking out.
I'm getting all my talking out. But I do think that it is important to do something this month that, definitely is checking in with your mental health and just taking an inventory, and seeing where you're at and seeing what you could do to, maybe be in a different place by next May. Mentally and emotionally. So that's my parting shot for May. What is your parting shot?
It's like folding a spring cleaning for your mental health into the spring is what I'm hearing for you. Well, my parting shot is a shout out to Bloodstream Pod episode 6, 30 episodes ago.
Whoa.
Episode 6 guest, Ali Stroker. Ali Stroker, friend of the pod, who we've known for a few years. She was once upon a time the first actor using a wheelchair to be on Broadway. Well, she's now the first actor using a wheelchair to be nominated for a Tony Award. She has been nominated for her role as Ato Annie in the current Broadway revival of Oklahoma. So congratulations to Ali. You can hear her on episode 6, a 2016 episode of Bloodstream, or you can check out the Blood Feed YouTube channel. Search Ali Stroker for more. Ali, congratulations on continuing to break boundaries and barriers for people facing physical challenges, especially performers facing physical challenges. Extraordinarily proud of you and sending you a big Bloodstream love from everybody here on the team. And that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everybody at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, and Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and our presenting sponsor, Takeda, as well as our segment sponsors, Empowering Women, Breaking Through, Stop the Bleeding, the Teen Impact Awards. Thanks as well to segment contributors Debbie De La Riva, Jerron Ron Hill, Dr. Galen Cole, Ryan Gielan, Amy Board, and Mama Sue Lynch. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast and the Ask the Expert Podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also email us mailbag at bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter at bloodstreaminfo at PJ Lynch or Natalie's secret handle. Reminder to check out program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time,
take self-care of yourself.
Bye, everybody.